Physics World.
Hello, and welcome to the Physics World Weekly Podcast. I'm Hamish Johnston, and in this week's episode, we'll be asking why people still believe in conspiracy theories, talking about the challenges of diagnosing skin cancer using smartphone apps, and marveling about how energy efficiency defines the shape of lotus leaves. And finally, we'll delve into the latest news about time crystals. To chat about this eclectic mix of topics, I'm joined by my colleagues Tammy Freeman and Mateen Durrani.
Hi, Hamish.
Hi, Hamish.
Now, our regular columnist, the philosopher of physics, Bob Kreese, has written a piece about humanity's enduring love of conspiracy theories. So, Mateen, what do you have a definition of a conspiracy theory?
Well, I know there's loads out there. I mean, some people think global warming is a kind of conspiracy manufactured by scientists, or that, people like the... Another one is that the UN is kind of hiding the data about Chernobyl or Fukushima, or, I mean, there's ones about John F. Kennedy being... what ones are out there. There's all crazy ones out there, and some of them are quite funny, and it's a dangerous... course of action to start believing in them, because they can soak up a lot of time and most of them are probably wrong.
And in his piece, Bob says that conspiracy theories thrive in societies where large gaps exist between the governing class and those who are governed. And, you know, to me, that sounds like any advanced society, because, of course, you know, to govern an advanced society, you have to have expert knowledge in something. And your average person is not going to have that expert knowledge. So does that mean that, you know, as technology improves and society becomes more advanced, we're going to get more and more conspiracy theories?
Well, Bob Kreese cites a book called Democracy and Truth by Sophia Rosenfeld, who's a historian at the University of Pennsylvania, who's written about this business, about this gap between the governed and the governing classes. And according to her, that people sort of reject science and its methods as a source of, understanding of the world. And they prefer to rely on things like emotional honesty, their intuition. And basically, conspiracy theories thrive because people don't understand the world. They don't have the tools to understand the world and turn back to their emotions to guide why things are happening.
And that, I think, can be that can be dangerous in a democracy, can't it? Because in a democracy, you have it's the opinion of the majority that wins out. And of course, we've had that in this country. We've had the famous or infamous will of the people, where an idea that many experts think isn't a particularly good idea is being followed through by the UK government simply because the majority of people thought it sounded like a great idea, even though, well, they probably didn't have the expertise to decide whether it was a great idea. I think we all know what I'm talking about here.
But of course, one issue that I think is very interesting that Bob Kreese raises in the article, of course, the gut reaction of most scientists would be, well, of course, teach the people the facts, give them more science, show them the papers, give them the articles, tell them all the information, and then they'll, once they understand it, they'll believe it. And it's not as simple as that. It's not really a case of just presenting people with more information. I mean, there's so much...
They don't always believe it.
No. Yeah. And there's so much information out there that, people don't read it or don't look at it. But even if they did, believing in conspiracy theories is a lot more... There's a lot more to it than just having the facts. And so that's not really the solution.
And so what can a physicist do to make sure that, their research it doesn't become the subject of a conspiracy theory? I mean, obviously, you've got physicists working on climate, but physicists working in other fields as well where misinformation could be spread.
I don't know, but really what Bob Kreese is saying in the article, and he's coming from a humanities background, is that actually what we need to teach people is give them the tools to understand the world, and that involves teaching them more about the humanities. an understanding about the philosophy and history of science. And once people have those tools, they can then make sense of the world. So he's kind of through the back door arguing for more money for his area of work, which is the humanities. And rather than focusing our public funding purely on the sciences and thinking that's the answer to everything, actually the humanities are really important, he says in this article.
Does he think they're easier to believe, that sort of people understand them more, and that's why you can sort of persuade people using that rather than maybe complicated scientific evidence?
I mean, he talks about giving them the tools to understand the world. I'm not quite sure what those tools would be, you know, but...
Does that mean a person might not necessarily have to understand the sort of chemistry and physics of the atmosphere, but they have to have faith in the scientific methods and the integrity of the scientists who do understand it? I mean, that seems to be the there's a credibility gap there, isn't there? You know, if somebody says, you know, I'm sorry, you're going to have to give up that big SUV that you drive and turn down your central air conditioning in the summer and turn down your heat in the winter, and you know, maybe not work in a carbon intensive industry. That's a lot to ask if you don't understand the process that conclusion came from.
Yeah, so I guess it's understanding the method of science rather than the details of the science itself. But you know, Bob Creese traces a lot of the problems back to even to the time of Galileo, where he talks about the world being driven by mathematics. And of course it is, but it's so advanced and beyond most people's comprehension that they think it has nothing to do with it themselves. And they think it's beyond them and that it's not part of their world. And so they turn to things like conspiracy theories because it makes more sense and it's easy to understand and it kind of interests them. And but it's dangerous, actually. And you'd think in the 21st century, we wouldn't be worried about things like conspiracy theories. But, you know, they take foot. And the other point Bob Creese makes is it's the internet, unfortunately, that spreads a lot of these myths. And they're so easily accessible these days that things spread like wildfire. And, you know, in the era of fake news and all that, you know, it's very difficult to know how to stem that. Actually, before we started the podcast, Hamish, I did a little Twitter poll. So the question I asked people on Twitter, and this is obviously very unscientific, was what can we do to stop people from believing in conspiracy theories that have no basis in scientific fact? And actually, most of the people who replied to the poll said, teach them more science. So that was 62%. 18% give them more of the facts, but only 20% said more humanities training, which is the thing that Bob Creese was on about. So it looks like from that unscientific poll, probably quite a long way to go before other people agree with him that humanities training is the way to tackle this belief in conspiracy theories.
Well, one thing that I've always been fascinated with is the sort of conspiracy theory that runs against quantum mechanics. So this is something that we've come up against here at Physics World. It used to be that that we had comments, open comments on articles that appeared on Physics World. We don't do that anymore, possibly because we would get a lot of very bizarre comments. But one sort of common theme was the idea that quantum mechanics was a big conspiracy, and that it wasn't really true. And the proof, of course, is that Einstein didn't believe in quantum mechanics, which, of course, is not true. He had some concerns about quantum mechanics. But, I thought that was a very interesting, example of a conspiracy theory within physics. And, does it simply come down to the fact that it is very difficult to understand quantum mechanics and that it doesn't jive with our everyday experience? In the same way, maybe, that climate change, up until recently, doesn't jive with our everyday experience. That could be that to me is maybe a genesis of the quantum conspiracy theory. But there's lots of conspiracy theories. In medicine, the anti-vaxxers, that's a classic conspiracy theory.
Yeah, I mean, and maybe some of these conspiracy theories don't do any harm. The flat earthers, for example, fine, let them believe that. But I think when it comes to medicine, the conspiracy theories can be quite dangerous. For example, as you say, the anti-vax movement, which seems to be working to try and persuade people not to vaccinate their children against, you know, all scientific evidence that vaccinations work, are needed, are safe. For some reason, these people just choose not to believe. And another example is the sort of the idea of Big Pharma, that they have this cure for everything, but they're keeping it secret.
Oh, they're just sitting on it. Yeah, I mean, for whatever reason. Because, of course, you know, they don't want to sell it. They don't want to make money. Yeah. They just want to sit on the cure until everybody's dead, and then there's nobody to sell it to. It is a fascinating thing, conspiracy theories, particularly in science.
And often those anti-vaxxers, they can be quite intelligent, you know, middle-class educated people who you'd think might have the wit not to believe in that kind of thing, but for whatever reason.
I think people quite often choose to believe their friends and their sort of, you know, people.
Right, their kind of immediate circle. Yeah. They sort of hear a message and then, yeah.
Well, I suppose if it agrees with a certain world view, then, that amplifies it.
Yeah, the echo chambers.
Exactly.
Talking to people that have the same beliefs as you, and then everyone sort of believes that that's true because everyone they know believes it.
I suppose the classic example is that, there seem to be lots of people who are willing to believe the scientists when it comes to climate change, but not believe the scientists when it comes to vaccines or genetically modified organisms. Yeah. So, you know, I think that, that's the idea of cherry picking your beliefs, but also aligning them with your sort of worldview.
Yes, definitely.
Personally, I mean, I think, things are just, it's going to get much more difficult because as technology becomes much more advanced and societies become much more complicated, it is going to become much more difficult for the average person to, you know, have a broad understanding of how things work. Our reliance on experts will increase. I sort of wonder, is there going to be some sort of tipping point where society where society can't advance any further simply because of, sort of mistrust of experts? I suppose that's not physics, maybe philosophy, something for Bob Kreese. You can read more in Bob's article, which is called Why Do People Still Believe in Conspiracy Theories? And that can be found in the Opinion and Reviews section of the Physics World website. And now we're going to talk about a new smartphone-based technology that promises to help people to decide whether a suspicious skin lesion requires medical attention. Now, Tammy, this is an article that you wrote, and this is an app on a smartphone. How does this app work?
Okay, so the idea is if someone sees, for example, a suspicious mole, and they're not sure whether it's just, you know, something harmless or whether they should go and see their doctor, there's these apps. Basically, you take an image of the lesion with your phone, and then the apps will sort of give you an idea of if it's high risk, low risk, whether you should just ignore it or whether you should go and see a doctor. And apparently between 2014 and 2017, there were 235 new dermatology phone apps of this type appearing.
Wow.
Yeah.
And are they all available on at the Apple Store?
I'm not sure. So basically, some researchers at the Universities of Birmingham and Nottingham wanted to take a closer look at these apps and sort of find out really if they were any good or not.
And am I right in thinking that there's some artificial intelligence involved in these apps, the pattern recognition,
machine learning sort of thing? Yes,
some
of these apps use artificial intelligence algorithms to classify the images of the lesions and sort of work out if they're high or low risk, yeah.
And of course, that sounds like a great idea, but there have been problems have been identified.
Yeah, so basically in this study, the researchers looking at these particular AI-based algorithms, they looked back at the scientific literature and they found 9 studies that were basically assessing 6 of these different apps. And they took a closer look at what these studies actually found. And basically, they found that the studies were small and overall of poor quality, to quote the researchers. Problems included things like, so the lesions chosen for testing by the apps were picked by clinicians. So they weren't just sort of users of the apps sending in images. They were chosen by clinicians. Okay. The images were taken using a study phone by an expert person at taking images. So not just by users on their own phones. Images that were low quality were quite often just excluded from the study. And another problem in many of the studies is that if a lesion was classified as low risk, the study didn't then follow up to see whether it really was low risk or whether it was, you know, perhaps some sort of cancerous lesion.
Hmm, that sounds like a major flaw.
Yeah, so basically they're saying that, you know, the studies that have been published to evaluate these apps weren't really in-depth enough and weren't particularly...
So a kind of flaw in the sample size and a bit of bias in the data.
Yes, right. Yes.
Well, so it doesn't sound like the apps are being tested in the way that they would be used by somebody who's concerned about a mole. And despite these problems, apparently some of these apps have CE marks in Europe, which gives them some sort of gravitas or suggests that they actually work.
Yeah, so the CE mark is sort of, like you say, it's sort of giving a bit of kudos to these apps. Two of the apps that were studied have been given the CE mark. Now, the authors of the study pointed out that in Europe, smartphone apps are defined as class 1 devices, which is really a sort of category for low-risk devices such as plasters or reading glasses, that sort of thing. And as such, it's not particularly stringent getting the CE mark. In contrast, in the USA, the FDA has a much stricter assessment process for smartphone apps, and none of them have been given approval. So that was something else the authors sort of highlighted. Actually, maybe there needs to be more like a higher class of testing for smartphone apps, that they shouldn't just be categorized as class 1 devices. Perhaps, you know, they need to look into this.
So are these apps free to download, or are they someone making loads of cash on the back of these?
I'm not sure, actually. I haven't checked, but I know some of them are obviously still available to download online. Yeah.
So it's a bit of a Wild West situation going on with apps, medical apps.
Yeah, but, indeed.
Whether you trust them or not is open to debate.
Yeah. Right, okay. And I think the authors were just saying, you know, so they want to emphasise that, you know, healthcare professionals must be aware of the limitations and they must sort of tell their patients, you know, okay, fine, use the apps, but if you're really in doubt, just go and see your GP. Don't rely on the apps.
Well, that's a shame in a sense, because a smartphone is such a powerful device. Mm. You know, a lot of them have very high quality cameras. Presumably, you can get a very good image.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, they've got processing power, and they're connected to the internet. You know, you would have thought that this could be done correctly.
Yeah, I mean, some of the apps did have sort of quite good classification results, but the problem is, as I said before, that the tests that they were using weren't really that realistic enough to give them valid results. So.
And, you know, smartphones are such amazing devices. Are there other apps, beyond apps for skin cancer that people have made?
Many, many apps if you just Google apps, sort of medical apps, there's, you know, apps to remind you to take your medicine. There's a lot of apps developed that's with some sort of plug-in device. For example, there's one that can track cardiac rhythm. There's diabetes monitoring apps and, sort of ones that are made for doctors. We can attach a scanning tool and they can do sort of ultrasound on the go via their smartphone. And obviously loads just for the sort of the general public to use. So yes, there are many apps out there.
Well, you can read more about this in Tammy's article on the Physics World website. And that article is called Smartphone Apps Fall Short on Skin Cancer Diagnosis. Next up is the physics of the aquatic lotus plant. Tammy, can you describe this plant for us? It has lovely leaves, doesn't it, that float on the water?
Okay, yeah. So what this study was looking at is this lotus plant. When it grows on the water, it has these leaves that are sort of large and flat with little ruffly edges.
Sort of like a water lily.
Yeah. But sometimes they grow on stems that are raised above the water and the leaves are a completely different shape. So they're sort of cone-shaped with sort of more gentle undulations. So the researchers wanted to find out, okay, are they actually different plants or is there another reason why the leaves are so different?
So this is a study that was done by Fan Zhu and colleagues at Fudan University in Shanghai. And what they did is they developed some mathematical models to describe the structure of the leaves. And they also built artificial leaves to try to work out if floating on water affects the shape of the leaves. And they found that there were two things that were important, Tammy. What were those two things?
Okay, so there's two things that influence the leaves. So there's the effect of the water on the leaf and also the leaf's natural tendency to grow in an energy efficient manner. So basically, when the leaves aren't on top of the water, the most energy efficient way to grow is to produce this cone shape. But when they're on the water, producing a cone shape would require the leaves to lift up. So that's like requiring them to use more energy. So because to keep the energy efficient, they grow flat on the water.
And so it's a trade-off between being, you know, sort of trying to pull yourself off the water to go towards the sun.
Yeah.
Or
if they're already on the water, I guess it's easier just to stay there and spread out.
And make a little ripple on the edge. And you might think, well, you know, so what? A lotus leaf is a lotus leaf. And do we really need to understand why it has a different shape when it grows in the water? But according to the researchers, having an understanding of how these different shapes develop could lead to the development of new techniques to control the shapes of artificial materials. So I suppose if you wanted to make a nicely undulating artificial material or a cone-shaped artificial material, you could either grow it on the surface of water or perhaps suspend it in air and grow it. And you can find out more about how these lotus leaves grow in an article by our regular contributor, Michael Allen. And that article is called Energy Efficiency Guides Lotus Leaf Growth. So finally, we have some breaking news about a genuine curiosity of physics, the time crystal.
What's a time crystal?
Ooh, I was afraid someone was going to ask that question. Well, a time crystal has a repeating pattern in space and time. And that's unlike a familiar crystal like a diamond or a salt crystal, which simply has a repeating pattern in space.
So what's new about this particular time crystal?
Time crystals that that physicists had described in the past, both theoretically and experimentally, had been quantum systems. And I think there was, you know, perhaps a belief that quantum mechanics was actually required to give the right conditions to create a time crystal. But now, a physicist, Norman Yao, and colleagues at the University of California, Berkeley, have done some calculations that show that time crystals governed by classical physics could exist.
Okay, so what form would they exist in?
Well, the suggestion is that they could be made from a series of coupled oscillators. And apparently, this sort of observation isn't new. And they point out that, over 100 years ago, the physicist Michael Faraday did some calculations about coupled oscillators, and the results, although he didn't use the term time crystal, the actual behavior of these coupled oscillators was similar to a time crystal.
So is this something you could make in the lab?
Yeah, I think I think there are some suggestions. I think what you need is you need a system of oscillators that are not, or that are slightly nonlinear. So they oscillate, but not exactly to simple harmonic motion. And then the other requirement is that they need to be. There has to be some sort of dissipation system that prevents them from getting too hot somehow, because just like a regular crystal, if the crystal gets too hot, it melts, and the repetition in space breaks down, and it just becomes amorphous. And so apparently in a classical time crystal, you have to have some way of preventing it from getting too hot, because that would destroy the properties of the time crystal. And so I think Yao and colleagues they make a few suggestions. Josephson junctions, which are sort of tiny superconducting circuits that are used in quantum computers, for example, could fit the bill. So, very interesting stuff. And you can read much more about this. And I say much more because it is a very comprehensive article by Philip Ball. And that article is on the website, and it's called Classical Time Crystals Could Exist in Nature, Say Physicists.
You did a very good job, Hamish, of knowing or explaining what you know about time crystals, because Philip Ball wrote another feature on Physics World, I think in 2018, called In Search of Time Crystals. And I remember editing that feature. And by the end of it, I kind of thought I knew what they were. But as soon as I finished working on it, it's all gone. And it's quite a tricky subject. I think it's going to be a long time before any of this goes into a physics syllabus in schools. But certainly, I remember the pioneer of all this was Frank Wilczek, who I think you've interviewed, the Nobel Prize winner. Physicist, who came up with a seminal paper on this in 2014. So I remember when I was editing that feature by Phil Ball, I thought I knew what time crystals were, and I've forgotten what exactly they are. It's quite a tricky, slippery, subtle concept that you think you've grasped, and then it just slips through your fingers. So well done, Hamish, on them. Explaining that just earlier.
Well, maybe I shouldn't admit that I've simply lifted a few passages from Phil's article and used them.
But they've got quite a cool name, and I think in the feature that Phil Ball wrote in 2018, he made this play on the fact that there's a Doctor Who term, time crystals. It sounds quite cool and sexy and interesting, and a good name can kind of get people interested in
in
weird bits of physics that they might not otherwise if it was called something very mundane.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I think I put Phil's article, I made Phil's article live yesterday, sort of midday or mid-afternoon, I think. And by the time I came in this morning, it was the most popular article on the website. So people love a good story about time crystals, even though it can be very difficult to understand. That's all for this episode of the Physics World Weekly podcast. My thanks to Tammy Freeman and Mateen Durrani, and a special thank you to our producer, Callum Jelf. If you like what you've heard this week, you can subscribe to the Physics World Weekly podcast via Apple Podcasts or another podcast app of your choice, or you can follow us on Spotify. Thanks for listening, and please do join us again next week.
Physics World.